Welcome to the No Direction Podcast, PaizoCon 2017 seminar coverage. Remember, we con when you can't.
This is designing appointments, right? Okay, yeah, I'm in the right spot.
There will be more of us, presumably,
maybe,
at some point. But we'll start it off. We're everything you need right here. Go for it, Amanda.
All right, so hello, everybody. Welcome to the Designing Planets panel. This will be geared more toward the Starfinder RPG, because that is what we just designed a bunch of planets for, but we're happy to talk about your general questions about designing worlds. I'm Amanda Hammond-Coates. I'm development coordinator at Paizo.
I'm James L. Sutter. I'm the creative director on Starfinder, but I've also co-creator of Pathfinder. I've been around for a long time. And I actually wrote Distant Worlds, which was a Pathfinder book that set the... Wow, thank you! That is surprising. So that was, setting the basis for a lot of the Starfinder world, just in the Pathfinder with Galarian system. And you'll have to excuse me, I'm totally losing my voice, so I may... And my mind, honestly, by this it's Sunday, so if I ramble or switch into interpretive dance, that's what's going on.
Right. That's what I was telling him before the panel started. He would do the interpretive dance, I would interpret it, and then you would put it all on the internet.
Yeah.
And it'd be a great time, right?
Exactly. Here's me miming being totally locked. So let's talk a little bit... let's talk a little bit about designing worlds just... how do you go about when somebody says, hey, design a planet? What do you even do other than panic?
So do we want to talk about... Okay, so a good thing I think to start with here is that James did an amazing job of building out the solar system. Yeah, Galarian solar system with distant worlds, and those planets sort of already existed as baselines that we then put into Starfinder and built sort of on top of that. But we also had an entire section... of beyond the Pact world.
Mm-hmm.
And so these were planets that exist outside the Pact worlds, either in the near space, which means it's a little easier to get to, a little closer to a drift beacon for your starship to travel to, or the Vast, which is basically the vast reaches of space. It's hard to get to. It might not even have had a lot of contact with other races.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of thing. And that was just our opportunity to go crazy and talk to all of the staff members at Paizo and ask who wanted to write a planet, and just get everybody's cool ideas down into basically one column write-ups with little art pieces of something relevant. And so we have everything from a nebula where there's a lot of mining going on in the different bodies. We have gas giants with hundreds and hundreds of moons and satellites. Things we have destroyed worlds, we have terraformed worlds, we have alien sentient worlds. It's just super imaginative, and so I think most of us started with a framework of what we wanted the planet to be. You know, we want the planet to be a technological race that's built upon ruins of an ancient alien civilization that nobody knows anything about, maybe doesn't know exists. So we start with the conceit and we build from there.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk a little bit about how you sort of build on a baseline like that?
Yeah. So I think a couple of just basic design principles. I think anytime you're building a setting, whether it's a planet or even just a fantasy setting, I think you need to have not just one idea, but at least two ideas that are pretty different, and then the intersections between them will be where things get really interesting. Because you've seen any single idea planet, you've kind of seen before, right? Like, it's like, oh, this is the forest world, oh, this is the dystopian world, this is whatever. You've seen it done, you know, if Star Wars or Star Trek hasn't done it, I'm shocked, right?
Right.
But it's when you start to put several things together and you're like, okay, this is a planet that's run by hell, it's infested by demons, but it's also a water world. You go, okay, well, that starts to be sort of interesting, like, it's some sort of, like, floating arcologies, but, like...
Right.
But what sort of demons,
are
aquatic, you know, how does this work?
Mm-hmm.
I'm a big believer in using science to sort of inform your fantasy. So, for instance, when I was originally doing, way back in Pathfinder 12, when I was kind of creating the solar system for Pathfinder, we had a couple of planets, but for the most part it was like, come up with a dozen new worlds. And so, to do that, I was really looking at, like, what are real-world astronomical phenomena that would be interesting to play with. Like, for instance, tidal locking, which is when one side of, say, a planet always faces the thing that it's orbiting, like our moon does, or like if you have a planet where one side is always facing the sun and one side's always facing the way, well, one's going to be super, one side's going to be super hot, the other side's going to be super, dark and cold, and the only place anybody can really live is in that sort of terminator line right around the midpoint where you're going to have good environmental reaches. And that became the planet Versus, the line, in Pathfinder's system. You know, stuff like that, or like planets that are tidally heated, so it's actually gravity making the planet expand and contract that produces all this heat and magma and whatnot. Or captured objects with erratic orbits. Like, that's where Triaxis came from. Before, you know, a lot of people look at Triaxis in Distant Worlds, which is the planet that has, really, really long seasons. Seasons that last centuries. So it's, you've got winter that is, hundreds of years long, and a summer that's hundreds of years long. And I swear to God, I started that because I was like, oh, an eccentric orbit where sometimes you're closer to the sun or farther. That would be really interesting. Let's explore that. And it wasn't until I was putting the finishing touches on the write-up and I was like, and everybody prepares because they always know that winter is coming. So,
and then Game of Thrones got popular.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, it was already, I should have known. But, so I think it's, if you can find interesting real-world things to play with, either in physical phenomena or in cultural stuff or biology, if you're like, oh, man, these bugs are weird. What if you had a whole race of these people? You know, like,
those insects that sort of burrow into another insect, or fungus that burrows into another insect's brain sort of takes control over it.
Yeah.
That's the scariest thing in the universe. And then it just wants to takes the bug and gets as high as it possibly can so it can burst out of its brain and spread its spores further out. Imagine that on a larger scale, like person scale.
This is kind of what he does.
And I just stepped in.
And talks about sentient bug people. This is Jason Keeley.
Oh, hi, everyone. I'm Jason Keeley. I'm sorry I'm late. Someone scheduled me for 2 hours of Darkfinder Delve in a row. And for some reason, that game's real popular. People really wanted to play it. I don't know. I don't get it myself.
And Jason is also a developer on Starfinder. Yes. Was really instrumental in a lot of like Starship Combat and stuff like that. But has also done a bunch of work on Alien Archive and designing cultures and worlds and whatnot. So we were just giving some like basic, starting overview advice of like, how do you develop a totally new world? And I was saying like it's often the intersection between familiar ideas.
Cool. Yeah. I besides my weird bug fungus, that's all I have to add. until I catch my breath.
Yeah.
So I think that James is starting to veer into something really interesting, which is when you're building a planet, you're building that baseline, you're building those building blocks for what the planet looks like, what the environment is like, what the seasons are like, what the terrain is like, what the history of the planet is like, perhaps is informed by that or vice versa. And so from there, you can start to organically build your campaign hooks and your adventure hooks. And so once you know what the planet looks like and all of those different types of features, if it's tidally locked, if it's got really long seasons, we've got a planet in the book that was written by our project manager, Jessica Price, that is a sentient planet that can manifest your emotions and dreams. And so it is this beautiful planet that looks like it should be a resort type of place, but it's totally devoid for the most part of intelligent creatures. There are animals and things there, but the moment that you have intelligent life forms there, the planet starts to sort of like siphon off your memories and your emotions and your feelings and start to manifest the things that you're afraid of.
And if you've got a low self-esteem, it's probably not a good place to be.
So you can see that where you have a concept for, a planet that is sentient and can detect your thoughts and your feelings and your hopes starts to build into some things that start to get really interesting when you're talking about running adventures there. If you have a planet that is a terraformed planet that has only partially worked. You've got, you know, areas where metropolises have cropped up, and you've also got the wastelands where, you know, those experiments have horribly failed, and maybe there are mutated creatures there because of it. Maybe there, you know, are a lot of hazards like giant acid pits or, you know, giant oceans or something like that, and then you can start to come up with, how do I run adventures there, and how is that interesting, and, you know, what happens when somebody from that metropolis has a dire need to get out into one of those areas, or what happens when someone from space comes here and lands in a spot that's not as hospitable as it's been sold to them.
Yeah, and I think something Amanda's both touching on and sort of demonstrating is that a lot of times stream of consciousness is your friend. Like, sort of you're responding to whatever the seed of the idea is. I find it really useful to just start running with it and run whichever direction you know it takes you.
Yeah.
And let whether you're designing planets or building monsters or whatever, try and see what the next logical step would be for a thing. Like, for instance, if I'm designing a creature, mm-hmm. right? Like, you say, like, okay, well, you can go two ways, right? You either say, here's what I want it to look like. So now let me say, if I want it to have crab claws, well, what does its environment have to be in order to justify those crab claws?
Mm-hmm.
Or you can go the other direction and say, I want to write this sort of environment. What sort of creatures would naturally evolve to take advantage of this environment? That's why, you know, I always say, and I know this is planet design and not monster design, but ecosystems are a key part of your planet. I would say I really like to take the National Geographic approach, like the evolutionary biology approach. I think that saying, oh, that monster's got flippers and snake hair and a laser tongue because a mad wizard did it is not nearly as interesting as sort of retro-engineering the environmental factors that make a laser tongue totally, totally reasonable, right? You know, because if you're on a planet where, you know, one of the main races is clams that build these super hard silicon shells because there's all this silica in the environment, and the only thing that can cut through it is a laser, and so the predators evolve laser tongues, like, suddenly you've got an environment that, though a little bit ridiculous, it makes sense, and, like, you can follow that thread into all sorts of interesting different directions, right? Because, like, even just from that, we could say, okay, well, there's a bunch of silicon. Is there silicon-based life? What, do they have big cities built out of this same shell material? You know, like, anything can be the seed of a setting. Anything can be the seed of a race. Nothing is too silly. A perfect example of that is China Mieville. Anybody read China Mieville stuff? Okay, yeah. In Perdido Street Station, one of the things I love about China is that he can take a stupid idea and through the power of his writing, make it awesome. Like, so you start Perdido Street Station, you're like, cactus people? Seriously?
Okay.
And then by the end, you're like, hell yeah, cactus people! This is great! So don't be afraid to go a little bit wild.
Yeah.
And because Starfinder is a science fantasy setting, that little bit wild, whether it might seem a little bit ridiculous, and when I not say a wizard did it, but like, you can kind of like fudge a little bit and say, like, well, there's maybe a tiny bit of magic in the air that sort of like got that lizard to go straight laser instead of some of like, oh, just straight up heat or some other, you know, maybe something a little more biologically accurate. I had finger quotes. Nothing. I don't know. But also, I mean, we don't necessarily hand wave everything away with a wizard did or there is magic, but that having that the existence of magic can let you do other things, like having a planet that you know has basically, you know, empathy, and then reacts to you, an entire thing, right? And maybe that is actually full on, oh, and then you get down to, oh, it's actually just millions and millions and millions of nanomachines that's actually doing and creating all of these things. And then you've kind of gone back towards the science route, but for a while it might seem like it's kind of fantastic, or you can have something where, like, there's a society that's been merging science and magic, and then it blew up, and then what the heck is going to come out of that?
Yeah, something that's really fun sometimes is to take a planet that is just a super basic, even Earth analog type of planet, and literally blow it up. Jason actually has a planet in the back of Beyond the Pact Worlds that is literally that. It is a planet that is had some sort of catastrophe.
Planet, yeah.
Yeah, go ahead, Jason.
Well, yeah, this is actually the funny story. This is actually based on a campaign setting that my friends and I came up with ages ago to run like a real short campaign in. It's just because I like the I like the word orrery. And I like what it is. If you've seen The Dark Crystal, you know what it is because it's that giant. It's just a giant spinning thing, right? Where that normally mimics astronomical paths and whatnot. But I just like the idea of maybe these are not just planets spinning around, but like a planet that's just chunks of land that kind of gently drift past each other, right? So reverse engineering from that, and you're like, well, how would that be? There was an accident with some gravity, whatnot. So it was an explosion. So this planet fractured, but the core still had enough gravity, and maybe it's just a tiny black hole or something like that that keep everything kind of in orbit around itself. And so then what? And then you know what happens after that? You get a society that maybe has to build bridges between these spaces so they can trade with each other, because some cities and people still exist. Not everyone died, and or maybe go hunting on this fertile ground that's over here, but yet. Once things have moved on, this is sort of a little bit like a Traxxas thing. Like, if you go from here to here, you might not ever see this spot again for 10 years, and maybe that's where you're from and where you live, where your family is, and you've got to abandon your family for 10 years just to go in this environment. And it's sort of mimicking a lot of like long sea voyages and stuff like that. So added that, and then man was like, "You want to have what these people look like in here?" I was like, "Yeah, I want to have what these people look like."
Yeah.
In here. So they have this weird alien life form with this climbing axe, and they have very and. You know, you gotta write in like, well, maybe magic doesn't, magic flying and teleportation don't work so well on this planet because magic, right? So you can kind of cut out some of the shortcuts. So when your PCs land on that planet, they've got to actually do crazy running jumps and parkours and climbing maneuvers just to survive.
And they build these like
bridges right? So people
are
that,
and
then
yeah.
like a month later, it's this. So that bridge just collapsed and it's gone.
So
Jason Keeley,
like, hanging up.
The most excited man on the Starfinder.
I've been doing a deal for 2 hours. My energy is way up, and when this is over, I'm going to probably die.
The Robin Williams of Paizo.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh boy, I tell you.
Yeah. So, and not just you, we're all a little punchy at this point and excited, but I want to open up the floor, because we could just sort of randomly spout off things.
Yeah.
It's a big subject, but I kind of want to know what questions you guys have. Like, what drew you here? Right there in the back.
So, you know, Star Wars, like, every planet has a single ecosystem.
Yeah.
Did you guys go with that idea, or more of
No.
There's a few that are like that,
but
in general.
That's sort of one of the biggest criticisms of Star Wars. Like, I'm not one of those people who are like, single idea planets are terrible, right? Like, sometimes a forest planet is like, oh, it's an entirely forested planet, like, that's cool, but...
Mm-hmm.
You've kind of seen it before, and also it is not always all that viable, right? Where you're like, well, but wouldn't the ice cap, like, wouldn't the poles be a lot colder? Like, why are you just going to have a uniform thing? And it also means that, like, the thing I love about Starfinder is that every planet can be a campaign setting in its own right. And you've got a whole galaxy worth of campaign settings, so it basically means that, like, nobody ever needs to do homebrew Starfinder, because your homebrew is somewhere in the galaxy. Like, whatever world you want to build can exist in the same universe as you know, Akaton or Earth or some other, you know, Hoth. I don't know. I mean, we can't officially say it's there, but you can't prove that it's not.
Yeah.
And on the rule side, we actually provide GMs with the tools for some of the basic concepts of the planet's ecology and environment. So we tell you, you know, what's the mechanical effects of a planet with low gravity or high gravity or no gravity, or, you know, a light atmosphere or no atmosphere, or a toxic atmosphere.
Weird atmosphere.
Yeah, all kinds of stuff. So you can use some of those pre-built arrays if you are wanting to build your own planet, or if you're wanting to set your campaign on a planet, but you want to sort of change things up a little bit, you can change the gravity level or, you know, something like that.
Yeah.
I'll ask a simple question. So, how do you change the gravity on a planet?
In Starfinder, or just
real,
in general?
Real hard.
Well, I know the answer for real world.
Yeah. Okay, then Starfinder.
However you want.
Well, yeah, I mean, like, you're talking about, like, your players can't go change the gravity of Akaton unless you make your campaign around that. But, like, essentially you can just say, well, when you're building your planet, you can be like, well, does it have high gravity or low gravity? You're making that decision. And then you, from there, if you want to be scientific about it, you can decide, oh, well, this has got X number of gravity, so it's probably actually this big or this tiny, right? And then from there, there's sort of, just generally, and then the in-game effects of that are like, oh, on a low gravity planet, you can pretty much jump three times as far. And or on a high gravity planet, you jump three times fewer far.
We tried to keep the rules pretty simple
because
we don't want people doing a ton of math. Like, even just, like, the math we did trying to make sure that, like, we had the gravity and the mass and the diameter right on all the planets. Like, turns out that's a pain in the ass.
Yes.
And we did it.
That's straight-up development, right? That's straight-up math development. But.
Yeah, and so we don't want you guys to have to do that. And we want to make sure that, like, it's fun to play on a low-gravity planet. But not every aspect of your game should be affected, or everything would grind to a halt. So, you know, it's a few quick, like, on a high gravity world, X, Y, Z.
Right.
And you're out.
Yeah. How often did you find yourself going outside the Goldilocks zone, and what are the tools that you tend to use when detailing a planet or civilization that does exist outside of that?
I think we live outside the Goldilocks zone for the most part, like, because every planet in the Galarian solar system kind of has something going on it, right? It's even the one that's closest to the sun. So we decided, well, what could live there? Machine life. Oh my gosh! So yeah, they can take the heat, and they actually might even, since they're that close, just be solar powered, right? And so we kind of start with what exists and what might be work scientifically for some cases, and then just. Do what James said, sort of like riff off it, sort of in terms of biology and evolution and whatnot.
Well,
I mean, we even, like, there is even technically a base on the sun, and because we have, you know, it's the Pathfinder and Galarian side world, you know, well, that's fire elementals and
high magic,
high magic in there, right? So
magic is really useful in allowing you to do stuff that's not just Earth analogs, but even outside of Earth analogs, like, I think you can have something where you can have, you know, a planet that is, like I was saying, tidally heated earlier. Well, you could, I mean, tidal heating is a way to have, since it's just through the action of, like, gravitational sort of expansion and contraction of an individual body because it's orbiting something, you can have a planet that doesn't even have a sun. Like, if you've just got a moon orbiting around something big enough, you can have tidal heating and keep that planet alive. And we have that. I can't remember, I'm going to get it wrong if it's Titan or Io or which one, but, like, we have a moon in our real-world solar system that will continue to be warm long after the sun goes out, just because of the way that's working. Similarly, like, you know, we've got a world in Pathfinder called Kalamahoy that's very much based off of, you know, a real-world moon of one of the gas giants, where it's an ice crust on the outside, and then liquid water seas inside, and, you know, there's heat coming up from ocean vents and whatnot, so you can have a whole civilization there. So, in case you can't tell, I'm a big fan of just stealing from the real world, too, because truth is stranger than fiction, like they say. So just take it and run with it. Yeah.
Does the support of the planet design also support planets which aren't planets?
Yes.
Like, for example, I'm playing a campaign at the moment where I have an asteroid belt, and it moves snake-like through the cosmos, affected by all the gravities. And it's got this spider-like race that keeps the integrity of the asteroid belt by linking the asteroids with web tunnels. And it's basically a floating dungeon through space.
Sure. That's great. And we've got the Diaspora is a little more scattered, a little more of a classic asteroid belt.
But it does have a river running through it.
Yeah, exactly, right? The river between. Which was not entirely lifted from Dan Simmons' Hyperion series. You can't prove it. But, like, sure was a cool idea.
There are lots of creatures and stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
I was wondering, what about, how big is Absalom Station? Is that planet-sized, or is that, like, more like city-sized, or continent-sized, or...
It's more like, you know, and this was actually something we went back and forth about with both Absalom Station and the Adari, which is the big Kasothan generation ship, where you want these things to be big, right? Like, they're whole worlds, but when you actually get into the scales involved, like, you can't really have a space station that's, you know, 1,000 miles across. I mean, you can, but it was going to be ridiculous to ever try and detail it. So Absalom Station is, I think, 5 miles across, and I think that the Adari is something like that from end to end. So they're like, they're small, but then you think about, like, imagine, you know, I was going for the size of, like, Manhattan, basically, but imagine Manhattan in three dimensions, right? Because it's not just how far you are across, now it's your diameter. So you can fit a whole lot of people in a very small space. So yeah. Other questions? Yeah, back there.
With all the different worlds that have been created, have you ever find yourself going into someone else's realms? Have you had to, well, how do you make sure that you're not going into someone else's realms with them?
Oh,
I mean, like another author or IP?
How do you not steal?
How do you not steal from the author?
Be careful. I mean, like, there might be, I mean, there's no way to sort of, like, type in this planet, this spinny thing, you know, like, and then get a result back that, oh, this is exactly like this thing that this person wrote about in the 1940s, for instance. So we just have to be careful. We're constantly reading and doing, watching TV and doing all that stuff. So we have our own broad base of knowledge that we try not to steal from.
Yeah.
Purposefully, and then you just try your best not to.
Yeah.
Right.
If you're drawing inspiration from something, I think the key is to, sort of make it your own in a key way. It's one thing to be inspired by something; it's another thing to just rip off whole cloth and steal.
You don't do that, but you could accidentally rip something off, which is why we have a whole development process. So if I write a thing, if someone writes a thing, someone looks at it, and someone else is going to edit. That's like 3-4 people who have then now an.
And can point out, like, this is just like this thing.
Like, just a sort of, like, a non-Starfinder thing. It's like someone wrote an NPC, and I was like, that name sounds really familiar. And it had been through writing and development. I was like, oh, this is a Neil Gaiman character. We can't call this witch Neil Gaiman. And we went back to the author. Oh, I must have just taken that without even thinking. Yeah.
Yeah, that happens all the time. Like, every once in a while, I will have something out there and somebody asks me, like, oh, this is totally such and such from such and such show. And it's like, I've never seen that show. That's a coincidence.
Yeah.
So, also keeping in mind that there's nothing that's 100% new.
Yeah.
So, just trying to, like, you know, turn tropes on their heads and not make stuff stereotypes and trying to, like, not steal, like, while you're cognizant of it, do not steal whole cloth. Is good for the process.
And that's what I'm talking about where, you know, I say it's great to have the intersection of two ideas, because if you're going to steal an idea, and ideas, can an idea really be stolen? You know, it depends, right? Implementation can be, but, like, if you steal ideas from two entirely different places and put them together and mix them around enough, the end result might be very different than what either of them did, and it might be unrecognizable, right? It's the difference between inspiration and outright theft. But, like, for instance, you know, we've got Triaxis is all about dragon riders, right? Well, you can't have a planet of dragon riders without Pern. Like, that's, you know, like, Anna Crawford got there first, but that doesn't mean that she's the only one that can ever do dragon riders, right? In the same way that, like, the Adari, I thought a lot about, anybody here read the Expanse series or watched the show?
Yeah,
I was thinking a lot about the Naboo, like, the big Mormon generation ship in there when I was working on that. But, you know, they didn't come up with the idea of generation ships, right? That's been around for a long time. So it's sort of like, see the thing that you like, drill down and see if you can get to sort of the root source material, and then see if you can come up in a different direction. Let's see if we've got people who haven't talked to.
Is terraforming a factor or a potential factor?
The question?
Terraforming. Do we have...
We have a couple of different terraforming planets.
Terraforming planet gone awry, like you said.
Yep.
It's sort of... maybe even it's like, is it still constantly terraforming itself?
So we have, two that involve terraforming. We've got one that is, like Jason, we were saying earlier, is that it was an experiment that that went wrong, and so only part of the planet got terraformed, and the rest of it went wild, and there are these sort of energy storms that are going around the wastelands and sort of changing things and affecting the creatures, and they're unpredictable. So the planet is very dangerous, so there are definitely, like, settlers and folks that are still trying to mine some of the more valuable things there, but, you know, as far as, like, huge civilizations, it's not possible because of that phenomenon. And then we have another planet that started off as being super cold and is actually being terraformed into a resort world for really rich people. And so there are all of these sort of high-level industrial operations going on, and it's this huge, you know, interstellar corporation that is working on this planet, but there are also these ancient alien ruins that are being uncovered, and so there's the story hook there about, like, well, how is that going to affect this planet, and, you know, is something terrible going to happen to this project, or is this just a neat thing for explorers to come and check out later on? So, yeah, it's absolutely a factor.
Back there, yeah.
Is there anything on plants interacting with other planes of existence?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Want to talk about Wes's planet?
Sure, yeah. Well, Wes Schneider, as everybody knows, is Paizo's king of hell. And even though he has moved on, he will always retain that title.
In our hearts.
So he wrote a planet that naturally has been sort of infiltrated against the... without the knowledge of the residents,
mm-hmm.
by Hell. And so Hell is basically controlling it as sort of like a shadow puppet, sort of vassal state.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's really interesting, especially because they're not humanoid, which I thought was interesting, right? It's not just a planet full of devils. It's like a planet full of weird bug squid people mm-hmm. that are being run by Hell.
Yeah, masked squid people, and the planet is in thrall with a very specific...
Archdevil?
Not an archdevil, an infernal duke.
Oh, right, sorry.
Yeah.
And I think we've got, Eric actually wrote the Shadrovar something or other.
Oh, and they're kind of plane of shadow.
They're kind of
shadow.
Oh, yeah.
They're being, again, sort of influenced, but I think they actually know that they're being influenced by the Secundiar. I never know these names.
Scanlanar?
Yeah, that's it.
Scanlanar?
Scaramouche.
Yeah. All right, so who... We haven't called any of you yet. Yeah.
Will there be a rule for rogue planets that have to be acquired in Star?
Will there be rogue planets? Yeah, probably.
Sure,
it's a great idea.
Actually, that is something.
Is it already a thing?
Writing. Did I forget to write that? Oh boy. Okay.
Right.
No, I think I did.
So Jason will be by to kill you after the panel.
I already talked to Rob about it. It's actually. Can I spill some beans?
Sure.
It's AP3.
Yeah.
With the fact that the EOX, there's the Corpse Fleet who used to work for the EOX Navy, but then went rogue, maybe not. But they have to. They definitely can't stay on EOX and do their ship stuff. So we talked about where would they have bases, and one of the bases they have is actually a rogue planet that is just sort of that they're trying to. They've been trying again and again to sort of. I'm pretty sure I wrote all that and all that, but it's a. Oh boy.
These are some deep secrets. I haven't even heard about
this. Yeah, yeah,
so, it sounds great, it's irrelevant. Canon.
There you go. And I think there's something about it, too, that they're also trying to, like, figure out a way to, like, it's moving on its own, but they're trying to figure out maybe put a giant engine on it, but it didn't work, so half of it just looks like it's got a big bite taken out of it.
So it just keeps going in circles.
Whoa! Man, I can't stop this crazy thing!
We have someone in the back we haven't.
Right back there.
I was wondering about the tech level of planets and if there's such thing as magical. And if so, are there forbidden planets like too tech level or too high tech level or too low magic or too high magic?
Yeah.
Is there such a thing like that?
Absolutely.
Yeah, there's definitely planets with a range of technology. You've got, your low technology planets. In fact, isn't Ori magic planet? Yeah, because they messed with stuff and they made their planet explode.
They tampered in God's domain.
Yeah, so they have banned, or I don't know if they've
No, they're banned. It's just that all the people have forgotten, like,
they
like,
just don't do it
know.
Anymore.
But then there's weird technology
ones.
We also have settlements. We talk about settlements, and we kind of have a sort of generic-y kind of settlement stat block that doesn't have, like, exactly magic item level this, but we say, like, oh, this settlement is technologically average, so you can go there and buy the stuff that's in the, in the equipment chapter, but then there might be one that's technologically backward, so maybe items of this level or higher aren't actually available there. So we codify a little bit here and there in terms of tech, but we haven't really talked about, like, magic item level, though.
But if you take a high level technology to a low level technology,
it's a problem.
Would that be like people get after you?
No, there's no prime directive.
Yeah.
Cares?
That's the thing is the galaxy is for the most part like a wild frontier. Like one of the exciting things about the Starfinder setting is that faster than light travel via this dimension called the Drift has only existed for like a couple hundred years, so people are still just starting this exploration of the billions of worlds that are in their galaxy, which means that, like, there's a strong you know, reasonably strong central government in the Pact worlds. But as soon as you get outside that, I mean, who's going to tell you what to do, right? And there are also, there are empires out there that are much bigger than the Pact worlds, probably ones that haven't even been discovered yet, mm-hmm. right? Like, there's, you can kind of do whatever you want. It's a free-for-all, which means that you're going to have, you know, probably some people do have a prime directive. A lot more people are just out there cashing in however they can, right? So you undoubtedly have high-tech people landing on low-tech worlds and being like, yep, I'm your new god. Like, let's do that thing.
I think some of that is actually going to get a little bit explored in some Starfinder Society scenarios where you go to a place that doesn't, you know, you're making first contact. You're going to be making first contact in a lot of our, not a lot, but some of our adventures. It's a thing that happens every once in a while. And how you deal with it, it's going to be up to your players.
Yeah. All right, let's go right there.
So it sounded like you guys may have had like some sort of like way to like create planets where it's not just like random stuff. You got rules like for like low energy or low gravity and stuff like that. Do you have like what kind of other factors? Like, do you have like this affects magic or this is going to affect your tech or like is it like a point buy system or like how do you, did you guys come up with like something?
No,
it doesn't get that crunchy.
It doesn't get that
crunchy. Yeah, yeah. It doesn't get that crunchy, especially at this point.
Yeah, and especially for those one column write-ups of planets, we didn't want to get too granular into, you know, is technology warped in a certain way or magic warped in a certain way? That's going to be for sort of other things further down the line. I think the stat block includes the atmosphere, includes the gravity, it includes the size in relation to the old Galarian. The diameter, you know, the weight in relation to old Galarian, and also the length of the day and the year, since that sort of, you know, indicates stuff like seasons. Yeah, like, it's a very short little stat block, and it actually modeled after what we did in Distant World,
yeah.
I believe. So,
yeah,
it's that level of information, very high level.
Yeah, because I think it's very important, like, a big thing about Starfinder is, like, one of my favorite parts of RPGs in general is designing settings and designing worlds, and the thing that excites me about Starfinder is you will never run out of worlds to design in detail. Like, you can always build something new. And we're really going to be trying to encourage GMs to build their own worlds. Like, even more than Pathfinder, like, you can play in the Pact worlds all the time if you want, but why not go out and explore and, like, you know, for a single session, just make a new planet and try it out.
Yeah.
And so, while it's important to give people rules to play with, it's also important to make sure that we don't make that too difficult,
yeah.
right? Like, I want to make it really easy for people to try out their planet ideas and have an adventure or a whole campaign set there.
Yeah. Is now the time to mention the planet of Backwoods?
Oh, sure. Yeah, go for it.
Okay, that's the, what basically
yeah.
what
yeah.
we're talking about, about this rogue planet. So every AP volume will have a one-page write-up of a new planet. That planet may be featured in the AP or it may not be, or it may just be something that we, hey, let's go crazy and do this. So that's, you know, six a year, six new ones a year, plus whatever else we end up doing. And it does the, you know, the same write-up as the one column ones. It's just
mm-hmm.
one page
yeah.
with a nice piece of splash art and everything.
Yeah.
More questions. Anybody we haven't gotten yet? Are we not going
to
hear yet? Oh, I'm sorry. Like, go for it.
Two quick questions. One is, how do you manage the daily resources on, say, a planet that has a 100-hour day?
Sure.
And the other thing is, how about a, maybe not a planet so much, but a civilization that exists completely like on the back of or inside of a space creature.
I like the space creature.
Yeah,
we haven't gone
full space. We'll have space.
I mean,
Nocturne
is kind of like that.
Yeah,
but
it's kind of weird.
But I mean, a living planet.
Nocturne is a little bit of a it's living-ish.
The mechanics more function like when you rest, basically. So it's not just like every day your stuff resets. It's more like
every
24 hours you can rest for 8 hours and regain, you know, your spell slots and stuff like that. So we tried to make that much more sort of agnostic as far as the way the planets are, because we realize there are going to be people adventuring in these planets that have, you know, the 100-hour day, for example, and they're going to be fighting stuff and they're going to have nothing left, you know. So we wanted to make sure that there was room in the system for those types of adventures on these planets.
Yeah, and we detail all that under time and how people measure time and, you know, how it relates to our own.
I mean, the people, the players for the most part, the characters for the most part, are going to be from your about 24-hour-a-day planet. What if you yourself went to a day where a planet where there was a 100-hour day, you'd probably sleep a couple times during that day because that's what you're used to.
Right.
By all.
Yeah.
So.
Right there.
Aside from the Pact World planets, how many other worlds are we looking at in the core release?
Do you remember?
Let's see.
16?
Yeah, 16. Yeah, about 16.
Yeah.
And then there's one in the back of every AP volume, like what we were mentioning, and we'll do more.
And then, and a scattered few others that are covered.
Yeah.
And also, it should be noted that the Pact Worlds, there's still actually room to grow within the Pact Worlds themselves, because we denote all the big ones, but both of the gas giants have a bunch of moons, and we list a few of them, but we specifically say that, like, Resident and Leobar have dozens of moons between them,
mm-hmm.
of which we've named, like, eight or something.
Mm-hmm.
And that's specifically because, like, I like working on the Pact Worlds. I want to keep inventing new worlds for the Pact Worlds, right? So they won't be as prominent as major Pact Worlds, but we can still create new stuff. I never want to, like, fully detail anything, because then I get bored.
So we were talking a little bit about different tech levels on planets.
Yeah.
The default system has, you know, the mix of technology and fantasy. Is there a way that you handle a world that's, say, primitive medieval technology with just magic?
Yeah.
Or, you know, the other way around.
We specifically built in the archaic weapons.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
one of the,
and armor as well.
Yeah, yeah. And one of the reasons we had to rebalance a lot of the math and stuff was because we wanted to make sure that, like, this game would have been so much easier to build if we had just crossed out longbow and written laser pistol. And instead, what we did was, like, rebuilt all of it. But one of the reasons was so that we could still have, you know, a barbarian with a long sword versus a soldier with an assault rifle. Sneak preview, the soldier with the assault rifle wins, which is how it should be, right? Like,
I was wondering more along the magic side, since, like, you know, a lot of your magic is tied in with technology.
Sure.
We still have a lot of barbarian. The long sword had a powerful wizard with him.
Yeah.
You know, does the planet support that? Does the default system support, like, all magic?
Yeah, yeah. You can do all magic, you can do all tech, you can do a blend of the two. Like, the rules don't care so much.
Right, well, we have all those mystic spells, which aren't necessarily tied to technology, that you can give to, say, a wizard if you really, you know, if you wanted to on this other planet, so that he can still do a 6th level, you know, brain explosion spell that is doesn't necessarily have any kind of tech flavor to it. And if you want to, you can take a 6th level technomancer spell and just sort of cross out the word robot and write a Ifrit in it.
Because they're not all,
thing.
It's not like technomancers only affect technology.
Yeah. Right.
It's like, it's a flavor, but they've still got, I mean, magic missile is
still
magic. Still
magic missile,
And you can still shoot the darkness with it.
You can absolutely shoot the darkness.
So it wouldn't be a modern science fiction or fantasy discussion if I didn't ask about Dyson Spheres.
Dyson Spheres? Yeah, well, we've definitely, I think we, did Judy do one of those?
Judy did do a Dyson Sphere. Planet.
Yeah.
Already handled, but there'll be more.
Yes, not only that, but one surrounded by dead chips that have been sucked into its orbit.
And I
orbit.
Hope other dead planets and mine systems. And
there's a, yeah, I mean, not that one in particular,
no,
but we've
but
got, yeah, we've got lots of ideas.
All right.
Yeah.
Let's go back there. Right.
Where information have, like, trade attributes, like if you want to do a Far Trader or a Schmuggling campaign, it would be easy to see what things are wanted where or what are provided where.
No, not in the core rulebook, just because, like, remember, we're trying to fit all of the setting material and all of the rules and starship combat and all this stuff into one book. So there's going to be a lot more elaboration down the line. So we don't really get into, like, the trade goods of every planet or anything right now. Right now it's mostly the big ideas.
We have a tiny, tiny bit in the equipment chapter about trade goods.
Oh, yeah, yeah, but
and
not for individual
not
planets.
For individual planets, yeah. So you can sort of start with that seed and use that to grow your, you know, trading campaign if you really want to.
And that said, we do talk a little bit in very broad terms about the economies of the places that do have major civilizations so that you can extrapolate fairly easily about, like, well, this economy, you know, it is very based on ore trade because, you know, there's a lot of mining that happens here. So maybe they have a lot of ore, but they don't have a lot of agriculture, so they are going to need a lot of fresh food.
They would
sort of
need a
in.
Lot of quadratriticaline.
You know?
Yeah.
So
Anybody? Quadratriticaline? Quadratriticaline?
What is it a reference?
Philistines. Star Trek. It's the Tribbles game. That's what the Tribbles eat, and they go crazy. They go all
big. Interesting. All right. Right there.
Well, that does bring up kind of another one. You mentioned, like, Space Station K5. Would space stations and things like that be created in the same manner as planets? Or would that be...
Basically, could there be a lot smaller scale?
Because
you
can
move to
planet
and
settlement. Yeah. Depends how big you want to make it.
Yeah.
Okay, let's come back here again. Sorry. No, no, it's great.
You spend a whole lot of time talking about flora and fauna and what it is poisonous to as far as races encountered, or did you just kind of hand wave and say, F of S goes to this planet, try not to eat the local wildlife type of thing?
We don't have a lot of, you know, races that are poisoned by very specific things, but we do have a lot of planets where there's stuff that is in general poisonous, or, you know, the creatures found on that planet are in general immune to that poison, or maybe they can craft or use things made out of that poison, but we don't have a lot of the Vesker.
So you don't get to, like, at the biochemical level, you can't eat anything on this planet from this planet.
Yeah, I mean, we don't tend to have a lot of that.
What we were trying to do is, like, introduce ideas like that that, while cool, shut down a game pretty much, right? In the same way that's like, geez, it's awful weird that there's so much breathable atmosphere and on all these planets throughout the system. And it's like, yeah, because that's really fun. Like, I like to have those problems, like the unbreathable atmosphere, the planet where you can't eat anything. I think those are really fun once.
Right.
But it wouldn't be fun if you had to deal with it every single time. So that's where things get a little bit more fantasy and, frankly, space opera. Like, in Star Wars, nobody's ever wearing their helmet. Right.
Right.
Like,
yeah, exactly.
All right, we got time for, like, a couple more questions. We're going to do lightning round. Yeah.
So if Jupiter and Zeus are the same, and I saw Phrasma on the one, how are you handling the gods? I mean, are they everyone, every planet, the same god differently, or
do
you guys talk at all about
that?
Go for it.
Are you sure? Okay, yeah. I feel like I'm talking a lot, but yeah. So this is something that I for a long time have discussed with Pathfinder's creative director, James Jacobs, because we had sort of different ideas, and now I got my game, so let's see what I want to do. But I think it's actually, it wouldn't make any sense for, you know, the squid people of Zebulon 9 to be worshipping Phrasma and have her look like a human, right? Like, or have her name be something that they couldn't pronounce, right? Like, that doesn't make any sense. I think that Phrasma I pick out in particular because I think that as the goddess of life and death, I think that she's probably the most universally worshipped god anywhere in Starfinder, and frankly in Pathfinder. Like, I think she was, like, the first, but that's gotten way into headcanon. But so I think that everybody's going to see the gods as a reflection of themselves. It's just how, as far as we know, intelligent creatures are created, right? So, sometimes you may have a god. Like, for instance, like, Iomide, who's still a big part of Starfinder, you know, she was a mortal human who ascended. So, like, she's going to be really tied to that form and that name. And maybe she would tell a new alien race, like, hey, this is what I look like. This is my name. Call, say it right. Exactly. But I think that most gods are just going to be like, I'm the god of all my creatures, right? And so if the snail people want to see Phrasma as a snail person, well, hey, that shell's a spiral. That makes a lot more sense than people. Yeah. Is there snail people? The Urugs are kind of like crystal snail people. I feel like the flail snails are still around there somewhere. I still have a deep love for those guys.
I think we have last question back there.
Kind of going off this question with that. Can I accidentally fly into Phrasma's court or Phrasma's?
No,
it's still a different plane.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Are spaceships able to go to different?
Sure.
We have the Drift, which is sort of a different plane, but you can only get there through technology. But we also still, like, Shadow Jump is still a spell. Shadow Jump? Shadow Walk. Shadow Walk. Well, yeah. You want to get a little further. Shadow Walk is still a spell.
Shadow Saunter.
And we sort of mentioned in passing that, Zonkuthonites, or some
Shadow
of
Drives.
Shadow Drives is are a
We're
thing.
Popular.
We're
yeah.
popular way back when, but now we've sort of gotten better technology, so whatever that meant. Something crazy happens. So yeah, ships could or at least dip in there probably, but they don't use that technology much.
This is headcanon. We've talked about it, but we haven't printed it. But like, for instance, I think in my heart of hearts that like Zonkathon's ships that like run off of Shadow Drives were probably really popular right up until the drift was discovered, and then they dropped it immediately because can you imagine what it must have been like to be on a Zonkathon ship as a passenger? Like, yeah. nobody wants to be on a Cuthite like airline if you don't have.
And you thought United was bad.
Yeah, exactly. And that's where we're going to end this. Thank you, guys.
Thank you for joining us for another edition of the No Direction Podcast PaizoCon 2017 seminar coverage, made possible with the help of Justin Sluder and Ryan Hiller of Geek Dad. To find more great Pathfinder audio, go to NoDirectionPodcast.com.